WGTD News Time is 10 minutes after 8. The morning show is next. I am very excited to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with the author of a very moving and illuminating memoir. It is titled Almost a Mother, Love, Loss, and Finding Your People When Your Baby Dies. It is the story of Christy Wolpat and the deep sorrow that she and her husband Brian experienced when she gave birth to twins, one daughter, one son, prematurely. And unfortunately, neither twin lived very long thereafter. Christy Wolpat and her husband were plunged into what you can well imagine to be a deep well of sorrow. And beyond that, of course, they were also not only contending with their own grief, but also with sort of the ham-handed attempts of well-meaning friends and acquaintances and so on, and confronted at so many turns by things that would just remind them of the loss that they had experienced. But Christy Wolpat has found her way through that dark sorrow. Not that a day does not go by where she does not deeply miss those two children, but she has found a way to live on, to, in her words, not just survive, but thrive. And she has written a book that I think can be immensely helpful to others who might be experiencing either this sort of sorrow or maybe something related to it. Although she says more than once in the book that everyone's grief is a little bit different and there is not one single pathway that magically leads to better things. It's a journey everyone has to make, and we learn a great deal by following Christy Wolpat on her own particular journey. Again, her memoir is titled Almost a Mother, Love, Loss, and Finding Your People When Your Baby Dies. It is published by Orange Hat Publishing. And Christy Wolpat, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me.
I want to make sure our listeners know that you are an elementary school teacher and you are actually at school, but during a free period having this conversation with me. I appreciate you making time for it.
Absolutely. Yes, we have teacher in service today, so I am on my own in my classroom, but ready to talk.
Very good. I also want to mention that your book was recommended to me by someone who is a very good friend of mine who used to go to my church here in Racine. And the connection is actually more directly with her daughter, Carolyn, who I understand is a colleague of yours there at the
yes,
school.
Yes, she is. We teach fourth grade together.
So I appreciate the fact that they recommended this, and sometimes when a friend recommends a book by a friend or a friend of a friend, that doesn't necessarily make it a great book. In this case, it actually is a really beautifully written book, and I'm really glad we get to talk about this. I wonder if you could, ahead of us talking more specifically about your story, maybe just help our listeners understand the distance now between you and when you suffered this loss. I mean, not only chronologically, how much time has elapsed, but also how this loss feels to you now, and how well are you able to talk about these deeply painful things now versus closer to the loss?
Absolutely. Well, today is actually exactly 10 years to the day when my water broke, which was kind of the beginning of the end for me. So in my story, my water broke, but I stayed pregnant for 2 more weeks. But it was March 29th, 10 years ago. So there is, you know, quite a distance in years. People ask me all the time, like, how can you talk about this so freely when it's something that's so sad? And it's really strange and really hard to describe. Sometimes I feel like it happened to somebody else, I guess, in maybe a different life. And sometimes I feel like it just happened yesterday. I have a lot of practice talking about it now since also my book came out exactly 1 year ago today. So, you know, now that I've had interviews and now that I'm a public speaker and I have to kind of get through it, I'm sort of able to detach myself in a strange way. Yeah, so 10 years, it's hard to believe, but that's where I'm at.
Wow. So we're recording this on March 29th. We're actually airing this on April 1st, April Fool's Day. And I wanted to mention that specifically because it was actually either you or someone from your publisher who, as we were kind of laying the groundwork for this interview, who said that that would actually be kind of an intriguing date on which to play this interview, on a day that we typically think about prank phone calls and other mischievous jokes we play on each other. In a sense, it is not the worst thing to spend some time with something deeply serious, and also because, in a sense, the kind of loss that you and your husband experienced felt like, in a sense, the cruelest sort of joke that life or Mother Nature or fate or whatever had played on you. What does that connection seem like to you now?
I remember feeling, and still do to some extent, that it had to be some sort of a joke. And I think it's like that with a lot of tragedy. You have those days for weeks and months after it happens where you wake up and you think, that didn't really happen, did it? And then it's like a just like a cruel reminder every single day. You wake up and you re-realize that it actually happened and that there's nothing, you know, you can do about it. It's just one of those things where you just can't believe it happened to you, even though maybe in some sense you know that it happens. Sometimes people like to joke about, you know, oh, I'm pregnant and it's twins, and just the word twin still kind of stabs me in the heart a little bit, and I'm very good at covering it up now, but it's really hard when everybody is just trying to have fun and joke around, but it is one of the most painful things. You know, I'm not advocating don't tell jokes and don't play pranks. I'm a huge prankster, actually. And I use humor and comedy a lot in my life, especially with sad things. But sometimes it's hard to believe that other people could think it's even a little bit funny.
Right, exactly. Actually, what you just mentioned and about when you hear the word twins just reminds me of something that I thought we might touch on, namely that when you became pregnant with twins, that was really important to you. That was a big deal, the fact that you were going to be giving birth to twins, and then the fact that you ended up having both of those twins die so young. That also made it a huge loss. I mean, in other words, it is no small matter that we are talking about you being pregnant with twins and the fact that both of those twins ultimately died.
Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I have all these memories, some of them I write about in the book, where, you know, we found out it was twins, and my husband was, he's very money conscious, and I love that about him, but right away he's thinking, oh my gosh, this is two proms and two letter jackets, and we would joke around about what kind of car are we going to need to have for this, and it became such an important part of our pregnancy. And, you know, it took us a while to get pregnant, like it does for a lot of families or couples. And so it became even more of, I had to sort of grieve two children, and then I had to grieve the fact that I wouldn't be a twin mom, which is something that seemed so special to me.
I want to make sure that we have a moment to talk about this book's title, Almost a Mother. I have to say, of everything in this book, and so much of it is so touching, For some reason, that moment was especially touching to me when I read of you hearing somebody talking about your experience in terms mm-hmm. of almost being a mother. Would you mind explaining that little story to our listeners?
Of course. Well, I want to say first that I went back and forth a lot about titling my book Almost a Mother, because I didn't want any... I wrote this book for other women. I wrote this book for people supporting other women, and I would never want someone to think I actually believe they were almost a mother. So you do sort of have to get to that story to understand why I picked that. So just, I want listeners to know that I think for sure you are always a mother. But for me, it was actually my first Mother's Day after the twins died. They died in April, and, you know, Mother's Day is right around the corner from that, and I begrudgingly went to celebrate Mother's Day with my family, not because I don't love my mother, but because I was just so, so sad. And we were at a store, and my mom was paying for some things, and I kind of shoved my stuff up with her so that she would have to pay for mine. I was kind of joking around, although I didn't. I did sort of want her to pay for it, too. And the clerk said to me, it's Mother's Day. Shouldn't you be paying for your mom's stuff? And I said, oh, she's used to that. She knows me. And she said, well, someday when you're a mom, you know, you'll understand what this is like. And my little nephew, who was only 6 at the time, who, you know, I have a 6-year-old right now, and they're so black and white. He looked at me and then looked at the clerk and said, well, Aunt Christy was almost a mother, but now she's not. And that was literally the springboard for me to start writing this book, because I knew that if this was happening to me, it was happening to other people. And I was so desperate to help people understand that your motherhood is not stripped away from you just because your baby doesn't live.
Mm, exactly. And it's so interesting because, in a sense, what that nephew of yours said, in all innocence, I mean, he in no way, of course, said that to hurt
right.
you or diminish you or in any way. He was, what he said was not entirely untrue. I mean, in the sense that it at least speaks to an emptiness that you were experiencing at that time and a sense of terrible loss. And
yes,
yet to frame it that way left out this greater truth that you actually, in fact, were a mother, even though, unfortunately, your twins did not survive.
Right, exactly.
One last overarching question. I can't even count how many times I've read a book where a book roughly of this nature, some kind of a personal memoir about something difficult, where the person who is writing it says, basically, when I suffered this loss, I couldn't find a book that would help me. And that's a big reason why I'm writing this book, because of this void out there. And when I read that, I always think, not in every case, but in many cases, you probably just didn't look hard enough. I mean, there probably are books out there, but you just couldn't find one. It isn't that you're filling a gaping void, that there never has been a book written like this, so I'm going to write the first one. And I don't think that's what you're saying here. But in a sense, that was part of what prompted you to write this book was, and I think in your case, there really is a void, or at least largely a void, where the books that were most immediately available to you on your bookstore shelf were really not books like this at all, and certainly not written from the place where you were going to be writing your book. Can you just say a word about what was not there that you were looking for?
Absolutely. As I started writing this book, I kind of knew more about what I didn't want to be in it than what I did at first. It was the same thing when I was trying to come up with the cover art for my book when I was working with the graphic designer. I knew what I didn't want, but I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted. And there's a story I tell in the book about how I'm a teacher, and books are my life. And when I was a little girl, books were how I learned about the world, and they were how I learned about things that I had no idea about. So when I was little, I wasn't really looking for books to help me, but they were. I just didn't realize it. And so I requested every book from the La Crosse Public Library system about infant loss or grief or bereaved mothers, and sent my husband to pick them up, and he came back with a stack of maybe 8 books. None of them had been written in the last 10 years. Almost all of them were written by a psychiatrist or a psychologist, which is important, but I always found that learning about the stages of grief while you're going through it is not helpful at all. It's just people like, grief is a journey. There's all these cliches about it, but nobody had written a book that let me know that I wasn't crazy, and I was feeling crazy. I was feeling crazy for the thoughts that I was having, for the anger that I was having, the jealousy, and most of the books that I found, even when I, you know, in 2009, the internet was still kind of a different place than it is today. And if you look on Amazon now, you can find more books, but they're still quite often, I call them like dewdrop in the water books, where you're looking for peace and you're looking to find the gentle side of grief. And what I mostly wanted was for a woman or someone supporting her who is going through this to be able to read a book where they are reading. It's, I wanted them to feel like I'm talking right to them and say, yes, I was the person who couldn't go to Target because I would get so physically angry when I saw other pregnant women because I was so jealous. And I was not proud of that. I was ashamed of that. But then as it turns out, as you talk to other people, and the second half of my book is about how I met people online who helped me realize that, oh my gosh, everybody, almost everybody feels this way. You're not crazy and you are not alone. And I just wanted it to be really raw and really true and really honest. And I found that books written by PhDs who haven't necessarily lived through it, they could be helpful, but they're not like the raw honesty that women need, bereaved mothers need. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Christy Wopat and talking about the amazing, remarkable memoir that she has written called Almost a Mother, Love, Loss, and Finding Your People When Your Baby Dies. She and her husband, Brian, suffered a terrible loss with the death of their twins, one daughter, one son, born premature, who died very shortly thereafter. And her book is indeed a very honest and illuminating chronicle of all that they experienced. So explain to our listeners, if you would, in a sense, what went wrong with your pregnancy, a pregnancy that obviously you were very, very excited about after, I think, maybe a bout of infertility. At last, mm-hmm. you were pregnant and pregnant with twins. Explain to our listeners at what point things began to, in a sense, go off course, off of what was expected to be the pathway of your pregnancy.
Well, everything seemed to be going completely fine. I had my 20-week ultrasound, where you normally have, you look closely at baby's anatomy to find out, you know, we found out we were having a boy and a girl, and everything looked great. And about a week later, I started feeling a little bit funny. I wasn't really sure what was going on. I couldn't really put my finger on it. The doctor said I was fine. I went in just to hear the heartbeats, and everything was good. I'm kind of an anxious person anyway, so I was pretty nervous. And on a Sunday afternoon, I drove with my husband to Prairie du Chien to meet some friends. And we were there the whole day, and so I got back late at night. Late for me. I'm an elementary school teacher, so it was like 9:30. But we went right to bed, and I couldn't get comfortable, and I kind of plopped myself over on the side, and my water broke. And I didn't really know that my water broke. I wasn't really sure what was going on. I just had this tremendous feeling of, this cannot be good. So my husband drove me right to the hospital where they did a bunch of tests. They were sure that I was already in labor and would have the babies right then, and I was only 21 weeks pregnant, so it would have just completely been over. But somehow I stayed pregnant for 2 more weeks. So the water on my daughter, who was the lower twin, had broken. They didn't know why. It's kind of like a chicken and egg scenario where either I had an infection that made the amniotic sac break, or that my water broke and that introduced an infection. So about two weeks later, I went into actual labor. The doctor basically said, if we try to stop labor, which we maybe could, you will die because now you have this infection. And so we're not willing to stop labor. So they were born, they were 23 weeks and 3 days. And at my particular hospital, at 23 weeks, they will try life-saving measures. But they were just too sick. So my daughter died about 8 hours later, and my son lived through the night, a crazy night of blood transfusions and total chaos and shock, and then he died the next afternoon. So they never, the technical term for what I experienced is PPROM, preterm premature rupture of membranes, but they don't really know what causes it. I was not in labor. I didn't have an incompetent cervix. So it was one of those, well, we hope it's a fluke kind of things.
What you describe in terms of the care that you received, I would say is a little bit of a mixed bag, although many of the people who cared for you did a marvelous job. And even in those instances that were very difficult, there were people who were trying to be sensitive and trying to pose important questions to you, even if you weren't ready for them. But I really appreciate the frankness with which you describe all of this, as well as the fairness. And of course, that the account also includes a lot of things that that probably should not have been said or should not have been done. And one of the most basic, of course, is, I suppose, unavoidable. But here you are in a place in which there are other pregnant women giving birth to perfectly healthy or largely healthy new babies. And here you are pretty much in the same place, experiencing something very different and much more painful. And I think you are pointing to how difficult it is when you have a place that is really designed for the one experience, but must also house this other experience that is so different. Can you just say a word about that?
Yes, absolutely. So the labor and delivery ward is a very special place. It's a very special part of the hospital. It's also where you can find the neonatal intensive care unit, or the NICU. So I delivered these babies. I labored. I went through everything that a normal pregnant mom does. But I couldn't hold my babies, and they were whisked away and taken to the NICU, and I was very unwell. And so I was unwell physically and obviously emotionally very worried. And so my husband and I, we had to stay. Our room was on the labor and delivery floor, so you could see moms walking up and down the hall with their babies, and you could hear babies crying. And it was basically torture. I don't know how else to explain it. It was one of the most horrible things I've ever experienced. Like, the cries of the other babies would make me physically, like, there's a biological aspect to all of this, too. Like, a woman has just had a baby, and there's no baby there. And so your body is sort of crying out for things too.
Right.
It was pretty hard. And leaving the hospital with everyone around me having like balloons and flowers and babies, and I just like walked out. That was pretty awful too.
Right. I just can't imagine that. And I remember one of the things that they do, at least at this hospital, and I would hope that it happens at other places, is that at some point you were given, or somebody outside of your door placed a card.
Mm-hmm.
And describe what that card was and in a sense what it said and what its purpose was.
So there is an organization. It's actually based here in La Crosse called Resolve Through Sharing. They're an organization that does education on bereavement for hospitals and other caregivers. And they have certain materials and certain things that hospitals and other places can purchase from them. And so there was a little card placed outside my hospital door, and it had a leaf with a dewdrop on it. There's always some kind of dewdrop. And so that was the message to everybody that, oh, this is a mom who has either suffered a miscarriage or their baby has died, or this is a mom who doesn't have a baby. And that's what that card signified. So, you know, I have sort of like a visceral reaction to dewdrops and leaves. I was very, very grateful for it. But as you said, there's still so much work that could be done in hospitals with advice on, you know, what women want or need when they're in this kind of horrible place.
Right. And when you are in this horrible emotional place, also geographically, in the same place where all these other people are experiencing such joy. I know that one of the things that you deeply appreciated, among many things, and again, I appreciate that your book is not just a laundry list of complaints
right.
about what should have been said differently or done differently. I mean, you also very much highlight the tender care that you were given. And one of the things you take great pains to talk about is a moment that involved your Dr. Brown, and a very moving moment in which she said something to you that was so important for you to hear. And this is as you were about to lose one of the twins. Can you describe this moment to our listeners?
My doctor was incredible. She took a lot of care to help me know and remember that none of this was my fault and that I would always be a mother. The thing I remember the most about her is we were in the NICU, and it's kind of like a routine when they're like, okay, this baby isn't going to make it. And so they move all this stuff out of the way and sort of make a little spot for you. And the nurses, I remember, lined up against the wall. And she came up behind me, and she just put her hand on my shoulder. And as they handed my baby to me, that was the first time I got to hold her as she was basically dying. She just was right. She was right there, and she did not. She was very brave to stand there and keep her hand on my shoulder and whisper to me that this is not your fault. You can't feel guilty for this, because I kept apologizing to my daughter. I felt like I had failed her. So I was sort of whispering and sort of yelling like, Mama is so sorry. I'm so sorry. And she was it was the perfect thing to have happen, that she just had her hand on my shoulder and said, there's nothing for you to be sorry for. You are her mom, and you did everything you could.
And one can't really even think of more important words for you to be told in that moment than that.
Right.
We're speaking with Christy Wopat, talking about her book, Almost a Mother, Love, Loss, and Finding Your People When Your Baby Dies. I want to just briefly ask you this, because I'm afraid we'll run out of time at the end.
Okay.
What was the experience like of sitting down and writing this book and reliving, especially this part of the story? I mean, you make a major point in the book of saying that writing itself really saved you. Mm-hmm. But I wonder what the experience of actually, in a sense, reliving all of this and writing about it, what was that like for you?
Very, very bizarre, very different, sometimes very painful. I had kept a blog 10 years ago during the first year of my grief. I had blogged and written everything down and written my feelings down. But when I decided to try to make it into a book, it's a whole different ballgame. So the first thing I had to do was kind of do my research, which was really hard. So I requested my medical records. That was very, very difficult to look through and read, especially because some of it I was like, I don't think that's the way it happened. And then I started questioning myself, like, who's right, me or the medical records? I went back and read my entire blog, all the posts, and then I started making lists of, like, okay, what are the stories that I can tell that would help women the most? And what can I put? I was very, like you said, I was very, very careful because I didn't want to just sound like, oh, here's a book about how terrible this was for me. You know, I needed it to end with hope, which is why the whole second half is about, you know, finding the people that helped me through this and the beautiful things that have come from it. Sometimes I would have to stop writing because it was just too hard to live through. It took me a long time to write this book because emotionally I had to stop. And even after my book was written and published, then I had to go back and work with an editor, not published, I'm sorry, written and submitted. I had to go back and work with an editor. And then it's so strange to be looking at it now as, okay, grammatically, and what makes sense, and what makes sense to the reader, and sort of take my emotions out of it.
Hmm.
And that was kind of a surreal experience, too.
Right. Well, I do think you tell this story so very, very well, and I'm sure anybody who reads it and appreciates the book also appreciates the time and the care that you took to tell this story. It could not have been easy. You tell in really painstaking detail what it was like from the ride home from the hospital to your house and walking into the nursery. For some reason you felt compelled to do so and regretted it immediately, and you describe all kinds of painful moments in those first days. One of the most intriguing, I guess, was when you are confronted with somebody at, I don't know if it was the crematorium or where you needed you and your husband to pick out the urns in which the ashes of your twins would be housed. Can you tell our listeners about this experience?
I can. And this is one of the stories from my book that people will say to me, that can't be true. And it's kind of funny to me because I wrote a memoir, so everything is at least my truth, right? So people don't want to believe, and they don't want to believe that a funeral home or a funeral director would not know how to handle a bereaved mother. But in my experience, it's kind of all over the place. So my husband and I, we needed to go and pick out the urns. And so we walked in the funeral home, and I remember that it didn't seem like anybody really wanted to help us. Like, I think I say in the book, like, I feel like they went downstairs and like drew straws or rock, paper, scissors for who would have to take care of the sad lady. But which is funny because it's a funeral home, so everybody's sad, I think. But when I said what we needed, she reacted in a way that I experienced so often, which was, you know, she just had this like sickeningly sweet voice, like, "Oh, well, I have some adorable urns for you," as if like I cared if they were cute or not. Like I didn't even want to be there. I was like, "Can somebody just put them in something and give them to me, and I'll figure this out later." I think she talked about how she had like a Winnie the Pooh urn. It was one of those moments where I just thought, this can't actually be happening. Like, can we just be? I just needed actually for her to be professional. Sometimes it's a little worse to try. Like, she just seemed like she was going overboard to make it seem like she could help me or something, when I was like, yeah, nothing is going to help. I need to get this done.
Right.
Check it off my list.
Right. I need two urns, and let's not belabor this point. But it's such an interesting story, and it just points to the countless ways in which both you and your husband over and over again were confronted by all kinds of instances in which not quite the right thing is said, or it's not said in quite the right way. And it just makes all of us really mindful of the fact that what we say and how we say it really matters. I mean, always, but especially mm-hmm. when someone has experienced something really difficult. In particular, you really had a problem when people would say that you had suffered a miscarriage, and that's not what you suffered. Your babies were born alive and then died shortly thereafter, and that's not a miscarriage. But it mattered to you people understand that this was not a miscarriage. Can you help us understand why that was so important to you, that people understand that?
Well, I write in the book about how at the time it mattered very much to me, because I often was made to feel like I shouldn't be as sad as I was. And so in my mind, if I could get them to understand, no, this is what happened. Like, don't you get it? Like, I had a nursery. I did this. I went through this. I thought that could impress upon people, oh, okay, now I understand why she is so sad. Maybe she's not just being a baby about it. And, you know, looking back, it was like I just wanted them to know that it was really bad. You know, like, this is something that's so horrible.
Mm. At one point, you talk about something called the pain Olympics,
yeah,
where we have this tendency to kind of categorize and try to quantify my pain versus your pain, my grief versus your grief. And, and of course, you say that is utterly pointless and impossible and not helpful in the least. You also talk about how one of the most painful realities was that the middle school where you taught at the time had, I think it was like half a dozen other teachers who were pregnant, and that if and when you returned to work, you missed the students, but you really dreaded the encounter that you were going to have with faculty colleagues. And then we can scarcely believe it, but at the very first teachers' meeting before school has even started, and you are finally back to work, there's a little ice-breaking exercise that we just throw up our hands in despair that someone would have thought was a good idea. Explain that moment, please.
Oh, going back to work for me was so full of, I was so full of anxiety and dread, and like you said, mostly because of the other adults. Kids seem to know what to say way more than adults do. And so the first meeting I was back, I was so nervous. And the principal said, you know, we're going to do this icebreaker. And it was, tell me like the best moments of summer. Tell me one great thing about your summer. And where my head was at that point, I was like, there was nothing good about my summer, because I don't know if you heard, but my babies died. And that was like my whole thing. Like, but my babies died. I don't know why you're asking. But so many of my coworkers, their babies didn't die, and they were pregnant at the same time as I was. And so we went around the circle, and it was seriously one after another, like, oh, you know, Jacob finally rolled over after trying so many times, or my best moments were just late night feedings. And I just remember sitting there like, I don't know what to do right now. Like, your urge is to just run away. I had to try to, I don't know. It's really hard because it's so emotional, and there's this, you're not supposed to be emotional while you're at work. And I was trying to hold it together and be professional, but it was really hard.
Right.
It ended with someone actually bringing their baby in for a visit, and I had to run out, and I hid in someone's office and sobbed.
Well, ultimately, what is the road for you out of the sort of the deepest despair that you were experiencing was the internet.
And it's, yes.
And it's just so refreshing to hear somebody writing about the internet in a way that is this positive, because, of course, so much of the time, especially now, we talk about all of the dark aspects of the internet. But for you, outside of your husband, Brian, who was unfailingly sensitive to you as much as he possibly could be, you have mm-hmm. nothing but really high words of praise for him. But outside of that, really the community that ultimately saved you was the community that you found online. Explain how that happened.
Well, I was off work, and I was sad and depressed, and I would sit down and I would relentlessly Google things like, my baby died, what do I do? Or, my twins died, what's next? And I didn't even know what I was looking for. I guess on the inside I was looking for somebody to tell me that, you know, you're going to be okay. But one night after I Googled it, I found a blog. And, you know, in 2009, blogs were new and pretty popular. And so I started reading this blog, and I could not believe it. It was like I was reading most of my story right there. I stayed up all night and read every post that this woman had on her blog. And I emailed her, and she wrote back right away and was very supportive and said, you know, you could do this too. So for the next probably, I don't know, year at least, all of my free time at home was spent reading these blogs. I'd read one and then find a link to another one. And there were women all over the world, Australia, England, Africa, that were blogging about this very same thing. And it was incredible. I would come home and I would have had something horrible in my eyes happen. And nobody in my real life wanted to listen to me because it's sad and people are uncomfortable with sadness. And I can remember I would type the whole story out with just, I could barely see the screen. I would be crying so hard, and I just had to get it out there. And then these comments would pop up like, oh, been there, girl. You know, that whole feeling of, oh, yeah, uh-huh, I got that. Me too. Yep, I get what you're saying. And little by little, that is what sort of drew me back into the world of the living. And we were all then trying to get pregnant again at the same time and supporting each other with the fear and anxiety of what comes after that. And through the internet and through those blogs, I met Bree, who is my very best friend, who lives in Los Angeles. And we ended up getting together, which is crazy. And she came last year for the launch of my book, and we meet in Las Vegas. But I still talk to so many of those women. Now we're on Facebook because nobody blogs anymore. We don't have time. But we all still talk to each other. And right now it's the 10th anniversary for a lot of us. And so we're sending each other stuff and just saying our babies' names. And you're right. The internet gets a really bad rap. And my husband was certain that some of these women were like old men just trying to trick me to talk to them.
Looking for a young girlfriend. And fortunately, in this case, that proved not to be the case. And,
right.
Yeah, and it's they have been a lifeline in more ways than one.
Yeah.
A last quick question. One of the things you say is that you feel like one of the things that happened to you in the wake of your grief is that it was such an all-consuming grief that you really could not be the kind of friend to others that you had once been. And, of course, there's nothing really unique about that. I think lots of people, when they suffer grief of one kind or another, that's one of the things that happens, is that suddenly it's just all about you and all about your grief, and it's really hard to open up and be there for others. You talk about being more absent in terms of friendships than you ever were before. What is that like 10 years later? 10 years later, have you found ways, in a sense, to be the kind of friend to others that you were before you suffered this terrible loss?
That is a wonderful question. Thank you. I have never been asked that before. I feel, and you know, this is just my perspective, but I feel like I am a better friend than I ever could have imagined being before. And it's simply because, you know, I feel like until you have gone through something where you need someone's words or someone to be there just to survive the day, I'm not sure you can totally understand what it means to be a truly, truly great friend. And obviously, I still mess up and I still miss things. And sometimes I'm still selfish because I'm human. But I've kind of learned that, like, the most important thing when it comes to friendship is just showing up, just telling, not trying to make the person feel better, but just saying, hey, I am here. This is awful, whatever you're going through. I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Or it's easier for me, I think, to celebrate people too. I don't have any of that, like, I don't know, jealousy drama stuff going on in my life, because I'm just genuinely happy for people when something great happens, because we need great things, or you get bogged down with the sadness of it all.
Hmm. Well, you and your husband are now parents to two children beyond the two twins. And life goes on, and part of your life is writing so remarkably about all that you have experienced. Your book, again, titled Almost a Mother, Love, Loss, and Finding Your People When Your Baby Dies, published by Orange Hat Publishing. Christy Wopat, I'm so grateful for you writing this book and for this opportunity to talk with you about it. And I hope a lot of people will seek out your book, as many already have. I could see it being a tremendous help to anybody who has suffered this kind of loss. And I thank you for being part of The Morning Show today.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be speaking with a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer by the name of Matt Richtel, and we will be exploring one of the great wonders of the human body, our immune system. And we'll also be talking about how devastating it can be when something goes wrong with the immune system. Matt Richtel's book is called An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System, A Tale in Four Lives. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. We want to remind you that The Morning Show is also available as a podcast. You can subscribe to it via Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Google Podcasts. Search under The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And this is one more way to experience The Morning Show and to look at past programs. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show.